thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady, and this is podcast number 234. This week, St Anthony is once again at the helm, and we have a very interesting guest and controversial guest, perhaps one of the most controversial figures at Celtic over the last 40 years. A man with a heritage dating back to the very early days of the club. His grandfather was one of the first captains of Celtic Football Club. A man who, when he came onto the board of the club, many fans were enthused. He had been accredited with the turnaround in the fortunes of a dying city in Glasgow when he was Lord Provost in the 80s, responsible for the Glasgow's Miles Better campaign, and came onto the board with Brian Dempsey at a time when Celtic were falling well behind the shadow of Rangers, and gave us hope of a new dawn. And for many fans, that hope was scuppered shortly afterwards with the departure of Brian Dempsey, as can be found on previous Celtic Underground podcasts. As I say, a controversial figure, but rather me drone on about it, it's much more important to hear all sides of every story from history to be able to source out your own thoughts on the matter. So, enough from me. This is him, St Anthony, with him, Mr. Michael Kelly. Yesterday's men hang on to today, hang on to sin.
It's my pleasure to be joined now by Michael Kelly. Michael is obviously the former Lord Provost of Glasgow and an ex-Celtic director from the 1990s. So we'll always start, Michael, with the first question, just to get everybody relaxed. What was your first Celtic game that you can recall, and who was your first Celtic hero?
My first Celtic game would be in 1948. That was the team when Miller was the goalkeeper. And the first one I can remember was the Danny Kaye Glasgow Charity Cup final at Hampden. And the player that stands out in my mind was not a Celtic player, it was a Rangers player. My aunt took me. She was married to Willie Hughes, who was a Celtic player in the 30s. And she pointed out to me this guy called Tiger Shaw. And that name, you know, it just stuck with me. The way he played, the aggression, it was so evocative, and really it summed up Rangers, and it summed up that tremendous intensity that we have when we play Rangers. One of my earliest memories of a Celtic player would be Bobby Evans. I think I would mark him out as my first Celtic hero.
And who was the player through the years that you grew to admire? Did you have a particular favourite through the years?
Through the years, the best Celtic player ever was Bobby Murdoch. People talk about Jimmy Johnson as being the best Celtic ever, but those people that voted for that were people that didn't see Johnson. They watched it on video, and those wee tricks were great. He could tear defences apart, but he wasn't particularly productive. He tired defences out, but, you know, in modern parlance, his final ball wasn't always particularly good, and he didn't score a lot of goals. Bobby Murdoch was by far the best of the Lisbon Lions. He controlled the Lisbon Lions. He made them tick. And for me, he was the outstanding Celt that I've ever seen. I would put Henrik Larsson as a very close second. The two goals he scored in Seville were... Certainly the header was among the best Celtic goals I've ever seen. Just a pity that we didn't take a goalkeeper with us to Seville, because we threw that away because we were too mean to buy a goalkeeper, and the goalkeeper lost all three goals. And how Larsson must have felt that night when he played his heart out and scored those goals.
I think the galling thing that night was that we scored two very good goals and we gave away three mediocre
goals in return. I mean, the third one was appalling. Mm-hmm. The goalkeeper had it, let it bounce out. So, I mean, you really have to go through the Lisbon Lions, though, to see what a great, well, great individuals those guys were, and they made a great team. We will never see that kind of team in Celtic Park again, because those players would have been snapped up and been played international football. I mean, even the goalkeeper, Ronnie Simpson, he was precisely the right kind of goalkeeper you needed for that team, because we hardly ever got a team attacking us. So he could be spending 15, 20 minutes watching the game. Mm-hmm. But when he came, when it came to him and he had to make a save, he produced, he had the concentration that an older man would have that a younger man maybe not have. And mm-hmm. I mean, the number of goals he, I remember he was, Ralph Brand, Miller put Ralph Brand right through, and he was just about to kick it into the net. It came over the 6-yard box, and Brand was standing alone. He thought, he's just going to knock this into the net. Simpson ran out and picked the ball up before it got to Brand. I mean, an amazing save. He didn't wait for the forward to shoot. He just picked it off his toes. And it was just, I mean, you could go through the team like that. McNeil, such a magnificent captain. Lennox, so fast. Chalmers, such a good goal scorer. Willie Wallace, working tirelessly, another great goal scorer. I mean, that just was a magnificent team. And my father, who saw all the teams in the 30s and 20s, and who was always telling me what wonderful teams they were there, McGrory, etc. After Lisbon, he said to me, that was the greatest team ever. Mm-hmm. All the teams that he'd seen in his lifetime and in my lifetime, he said that was the very best, and we would never see a team like that again.
That's quite a compliment.
Well, that's an evaluation of somebody that knew football. He played mm-hmm. for Hibs. His father wouldn't let him sign for Celtic. Wouldn't let any of his sons sign for Celtic.
Well, that brings me on to, because you are the grandson of James Kelly,
who is
generally regarded as being the first great Celtic player.
He was the first player that Celtic signed. Mm-hmm. He was Scotland's centre-half. So you can imagine, he was the Billy McNeil, the star of his day.
Yeah.
And when Celtic were formed, they knew that to attract the right kind of players, they had to get a star. Mm-hmm. And they signed him. He was the first player to sign. He was the captain, of course. And he won all the trophies there were to win. He was part of the Renton team. Before he came to Celtic, he played for Renton.
The famous world champions.
And he was the world champion, yes. They were the world champions. Mm-hmm. So he came to Celtic after that, at the peak of his power, centre-half for Scotland, played for Celtic, later on became a director and became chairman.
Well, we're going to move on to that, but what I was going to ask you first there about James Kelly was, what kind of influence did he have on your family, and how were Celtic's early days described to you as a boy?
Well, sadly, he died in 1931, and I was born in 1940, so I never knew him. But the Celtic values were passed down through the family. He had educated his sons in Celtic, and they passed their knowledge on to me and to the rest of my sisters and cousins. And it was about the ethics of Celtic, being much more than a team, much more than a club, certain very high standards, always committed to attacking football, always trying to be fair, always been sporting, not doing anything underhand. And those principles really, I think, were fundamental to Celtic and made Celtic what they were. And I've always tried to stand by them and implement them. Mm-hmm. Contrary to what people may think and believe, the propaganda that they heard, the family made very, very little out of Celtic. Just to speaking for myself, I never had any director's fees whatsoever from Celtic. And the shareholders were never paid any dividends. That money went back into the club. And that was part of the ethics. You see certain clubs now where people are buying shares in them, taking control over them, simply to make money from the shares and to take as much out of the club as they can. That was never the case with Celtic.
So how did the Kelly link with the club come about at board level then?
Well, because he was such a great player, he was invited to join the board. He bought shares. He wasn't paid particularly well as a football player, but he paid better than the average working man at that time. And he was a very astute businessman. After he stopped playing, he bought pubs, he bought an engineering work, he bought hotels, not all at once, but he built that up from about 1905 to 1930. So he was able to buy shares in Celtic, and those shares allowed him to go on the board, and those were passed on to his eldest surviving son. His eldest son, who would have been a star footballer and would have been the director. Frank Kelly was killed in the First World War. Mm. He was in the Highland Light Infantry. And his brother, the next eldest, James Kelly, Jim, he was gassed in the First World War and was unfit. Died in the 1950s as a result of the gassing. So, you know, there's no doubt that Celtic and the Kelly family contributed to the defence of the United Kingdom, and were very, very glad to do that. They called the club Celtic, of course, rather than Hibernian, because they wanted to emphasise the link between the immigrant community here and Scotland. They were very grateful to Scotland for having found them a place here. His father, James Kelly's father, came over here in 1840. But he wasn't an immigrant, of course, because in 1840, the whole of Ireland was part of the United Kingdom. So he just moved from one part of the United Kingdom to another. Mm-hmm. But he got a job. He was a blacksmith
down in Alexandria. What part of Ireland did he come from?
Pardon?
What part of Ireland?
He came from Newry.
In the north?
As far as, well, now the north.
Yeah, yeah.
But, of course, it wasn't the north. Then it was
the north of the island.
The north of Ireland, yes. Mm-hmm. But it was, of course, fully part of the UK at that time. And he came over here and he married a Campbell, called Mary Campbell, from Alexandria, was a blacksmith. His son turned out to be a great footballer, and that's how the Celtic connection developed.
So your father's brother was Sir Robert Kelly.
That's correct.
Who we all know as being the Celtic chairman of the period.
That's right, from the 1850s. From after the war, really.
Yeah, up until he died in 71.
Yes.
So I understand that your dad and Desmond White at one point actually approached Matt Busby to be Celtic manager.
That's correct. That was in 1948 or so.
And would that have been because of poor results?
Yes, it was because of indifferent results under the current manager, McGrory, at the time. And Jimmy was a great player, but he was never a manager and never performed as a manager. Desmond White was on the board at the time, and my father agreed to support him to try and get him... Matt Busby as the manager.
And was Matt for coming?
I don't know that. Mm. So this is a factual record. I'll not guess, but I would assume that they had approached him to make sure that they could get him on board. But Bob Kelly, my uncle, did not want Matt Busby. As it turned out, he wanted someone that he would do what
he could manipulate. Yeah.
I mean, he picked the team. Mm. He said who would be signed and who wouldn't sign. And McGrory never took any responsibility for that. So... Mm. Clearly, Bob Kelly did not want a strong personality who would stand up to him. And it was only as a result of very, very poor performances in the 1960s and declining attendances that he eventually had to turn to Steen. Mm-hmm. Because, as you know, Steen was the assistant coach. He was a coach at Celtic mm-hmm. Park. He was allowed to go. He went to Dunfermline, won the cup against Celtic. Disastrous day, that appalling wedding evening at Amnon. And then he went to Hibs, won the Summer Cup, and eventually he came to Celtic Park. And, of course... He insisted on absolutely full control of the team, and he got it.
So understand at that point, there was a wee rift between it in the family, between your dad and
yes,
Robert Kelly.
Yes, there was
sad.
It was a severe falling out between Bob, my uncle, and my father, David, and my other younger uncle, Pat, who had supported this move for mm-hmm. Busby. And Bob really never forgave them for that. Mm-hmm. Which was very sad. I can't understand a family falling out like that, but it was a big divide.
So how come Bob Kelly got on the board and not your dad, for example?
He was older.
Was it just because he was like the older member
yes,
of the family?
Yes, he was the oldest member at that time in 1931, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So moving on a wee bit, did you actually get to Lisbon in 67?
No, I didn't. I changed jobs. I was a university lecturer at Aberdeen, and I changed jobs in April. I started at the University of Strathclyde in April the 1st. About my joke, but university holidays are very long, and I simply couldn't ask for time off during term to go in June. So mm-hmm. I saw the game on television.
So again, moving on a wee bit, that you were the youngest Lord Provost in Glasgow for 250 years when you were appointed
right.
in 1979.
Yes.
And not long after
1980.
That. 1980, sorry.
I was appointed in May 1980.
Well, I was just going to say that would have been very shortly before the 1980 Riot Cup final.
That was my very first public engagement. I was appointed on the Thursday. Mm-hmm. Appointed on Thursday, and I went to the game as Lord Provost on the Saturday. Mm. And I had to appear on television trying to explain the disgraceful scenes.
Mm. That wasn't a great advert for the city at all, was it?
Well, it wasn't a great advert for the police.
No.
That was the problem. Mm. The police abandoned Hampden I mean, there's various theories. Either they didn't know there was extra time, because that was the first time there'd been extra time in a cup final. So they all left. So when Celtic tried to do the lap of honour and the Rangers supporters decided to stop the lap of honour, which wasn't the first time they tried to do that, but they took exception to the fact that Celtic had won the cup and were parading around half the stadium. They didn't go to the Rangers end. They invaded the pitch and there was no one then, no police to stop them coming on. So, I mean, it was entirely the fault of the police. If the police had been there doing their job properly, no one would have come onto the pitch from the Rangers end, and then the idiots from the Celtic end wouldn't have come on to join in, which was ludicrous. So it was very, very embarrassing for that. And I can assure you that the police were told in no uncertain terms by Ernie Walker, who was the SFA secretary at the time, what he thought of them. So the other theory was that they weren't being paid overtime, so they left.
That wouldn't surprise me either. But did you find it difficult sitting there as Lord Provost and trying not to celebrate Celtic winning?
I always celebrated Celtic winning, and in fact, I fell out with the young Donald of Aberdeen, the Aberdeen director, and when the
Ian Donald.
Father was David. He was a nice guy's father, but. It was, I think it was a semi-final. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was a semi-final when Charlie Nicholas was expected to play for Celtic. And
we lost 1-0, yeah.
And I was shouting for Celtic, because Doug Rugby was kicking lumps out of people. And Ian Donald objected to this and said, Lord Provost, would you go and sit on the Celtic side? And I thought that was extremely rude of him. You know, if you're not allowed to support your own team. But I mean, apart from any other, it was the Glasgow team. Against
you're
the non-Glasgow
Glasgow, that's right.
So if it'd been most other Glasgow teams, I would have been supporting them against Aberdeen.
So Robert Kelly and Desmond White were Celtic chairman for almost 40 years. They were very powerful personalities and strong leaders.
They were.
I mean they did have faults, but overall they were seen as very, very strong leaders. And they were also seen as great legislators for the game in Scottish football. Now, I feel personally that after White's death in 1985, there was a void in the board.
Well, no, that was Desmond White's fault. I mean, it was both Bob and Desmond White really didn't plan for the future. You know, there should have been a structure laid down. I mean, they were old men, older men in their 70s who'd been on the board for a long time, and there really was no plans for the succession. Because Desmond White didn't expect to die.
Well, he died very suddenly in holiday.
He died in holiday. He was a scuba diver, and he died in Corfu or Crete or somewhere. But, I mean, he didn't expect to die at that time. He thought he was going to carry on. And he never planned for the succession. So there was not anybody, really, that I would have said was of sufficient calibre to be on that board at that time. So you had, from his death, for the next 10, 15 years, a rudderless board that just meandered along, and things went from bad to worse. Now, I mean, people don't actually know that I was only on the board for 3.5 years. I was a non-executive director. I wasn't running Celtic. I wasn't getting paid by Celtic. I mean, on the night that McCann took over, the fans outside were chanting, "Kelly's on the dole," which I thought was something distasteful for Celtic supporters to do that. I mean, you know, unemployment is not something to laugh about. No. It's not something to sneer at people being unemployed. And I thought, really, that was not a Celtic principle. Those people were not Celtic supporters. You're laughing at somebody on the dole. But it was also ignorant, because, of course, I didn't have a job with Celtic. So I had a job, which I was not unemployed for, and I carried on having a salary for that. So it was a mixture of a very bad taste and ignorance, that. But they didn't realise I was on there for 3.5 years. It wasn't this long period of decline was not in any way my responsibility.
Well, what I was trying to suggest there was that at the time when Desmond died, it was ironic that Lawrence Marlborough put Graeme Souness in charge at Ibrox, David Holmes came in, things began to change in Scottish football. English players were coming, and guys like Jack McGinn and I think it was Tom Devlin who was very short-lived.
Yeah.
They weren't really of the sufficient strength of leadership that Celtic needed at that time.
Absolutely correct. Yeah, I mean, Rangers were beginning to change at that time. But let's not forget the seeds of Rangers' destruction were sown at that time. Once David Murray took Rangers over, he embarked on a course that led to their liquidation.
We'll talk about that because he's an interesting character that I would like to move on to. But Chris White was the largest shareholder.
Yes.
And with hindsight looking back, do you think Chris should have taken on the chairman's role himself?
No, I don't think Chris was ever wanted to be chairman and would not have had the strength of personality to be chairman. I think he should have looked for someone and invited someone in independently, possibly an independent Celtic supporter. No, or somebody didn't have shares in the club or appointed a chief executive.
So you're a successful Lord Provost with Glasgow and you've got the Miles Better logo, everything is going. You've got your own PR firm, etc. Things are going very well. There was a great feeling of optimism when you and Brian Dempsey became directors in 1990. So at the time you became a director, what would your hopes have been at that time?
My hope was there was to modernise Celtic, to bring in people that could actually run it correctly and eventually to raise more capital, particularly through the fans, to try and provide the money that needed for the restoration of the stadium and for the restoration of the team. We were competing with Rangers at that time we're not competing properly with Rangers. Rangers were dominating Scottish football and I knew we needed to revive that.
So Fergus McCann, for example, he first approached the Celtic board in 1989 before you became
long before, director. Fergus was there long before me. He approached Jack McGinn and was rejected.
So he wanted 51% control for £7.4 million investment, that he wouldn't take any dividend for 5 years, etc. So
again, and he would only take a 10% return on his money.
So again, looking back on it, and hindsight's a wonderful thing. We could all be, you know, it's an easy thing to say, but looking back on it, do you wish the board would have accepted Fergus then?
No, I don't think so. I didn't really see that Fergus was the answer at that time, and while Fergus built a stadium and stabilised the finances, I would think that Celtic have not lost a lot. If you look at Celtic now, the way Celtic is, it's not the Celtic that there was before. It's the same company, it's the same club, but it's now a business, and business comes first. You see, there was a lot of incompetent directors on the board when I was on the board. Now I was, you know, I'm a track record of being a success, so I knew what I was doing. But there were people on there that were not particularly competent. But each and every one of them was a Celtic supporter. And each and every one of them was interested only in the team. It was, you know, the fans were devastated at the defeat. All the directors were as well. I mean, we wanted the team to win. Now, so that the focus was entirely in football. Everything else was secondary to the football. We wanted the best team. Now we have a company which is run very successfully, and this is what the fans wanted. They said, we want the club run as a business. It's been run as a business. So that means it's been run as for the benefit of the shareholders. Now, a lot of fans are shareholders, but the main shareholder, Dermot Desmond, runs the club for the benefit of the shareholders, because that's what a business is required to do. As a company director, that is your responsibility, run it for the shareholders. So the business now is coming first and the football is second. You've seen that in the last few years when we happen upon a good player or breed a good player. We don't say, oh good, that has now got a goalie. Let's get a centre half and a centre forward and have the backbone of the team and build around that. Or, oh great, we've got a tremendously creative midfield player now, we just got a striker. We breed these people, we bring them on, these players, and then we sell them on. And we replace them generally with poorer quality. And if we're looking at the current team is certainly nothing like as good as the team was under Martin O'Neill when you had the Sutton and the Hearts and etc. Mm-hmm. So it's been run economically, sensibly, very professionally, properly managed. I have a great admiration for Peter Lawwell as a manager, but he doesn't set the policy. He is told what to do by the board, and he does it very, very well. But the first goal here is not to win. Mm-hmm. The first goal is to make it a profitable business. And as long as we're competing in the league, as long as we're making a show in Europe. We're not, you know, there's no pretense that we're trying to win the European Cup, is there? There's no pretense we're really
Is it not a case now that because we come from a very small league, we don't have great TV revenues and things like that, but we're hamstrung a wee bit, whereas in the old days...
Well, is that how you'd analyse Manchester City or Chelsea? Not that at all. It's not the revenues that they get.
They're owned by...
They're owned by foreign-based millionaires.
Billionaires.
What's the difference at Celtic?
Well, the thing is, though, but we can't, even if you were to pay players £50,000-£60,000 a week, they wouldn't necessarily want to play in the SPL in the current climate.
But they'd be playing in the European Cup every single year. And if you had a good team, they'd have a chance of winning the European Cup. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we look at teams in England who have got owned by foreign-based billionaires who put millions into the club. But that's not happening with us, is it?
Is it not a good thing, though, that Dermot Desmond doesn't get us into a position that David Murray got us in, where we rely on one man's income, and therefore when he falls through, then we're in a false position?
So you think Manchester City and Chelsea and Manchester United are all in a false position?
Well, God forbid if Abramovich dropped dead tomorrow, there's no guarantee that his family would carry on with Chelsea.
Yeah, but the difference, you see, I think, between David Murray and these people is that David Murray wasn't putting his own money in.
Correct.
David Murray was borrowing money from the bank.
It was smoking mirrors.
We suddenly discover that the Murray revolution was built on sand, and it was absolutely disastrous for Rangers, so I'm certainly not advocating that for sale.
Again, but we'll come back to Murray. I want to give him his own wee special mention. Now, by 1992, you and Dempsey are on... Sorry, but, yeah. It was 1990, and Celtic were having problems with revenue for building a new stadium after the Taylor Report. So Dempsey was a property developer with said to be experience in land deals.
Yes.
Now, he wanted Celtic to move to Rob Royson.
Yes.
For what was described as a stadium, hotel, retail, housing complex.
Yes.
And then 48 hours before the cup final against Rangers, you and Chris conspired to put Dempsey off the board. Now, there was reasons why you'd done that at the time, but you never ever made them public.
Well, because they're sensitive reasons, and I'm not prepared to go into them any more than I did in my book, but I thought there were good and valid reasons for falling out with Brian Dempsey, whom, incidentally, I see in Labour Party meetings now and talk to. It was never a personal thing in that way. But I think I'd like to pose the question. You're talking about Rob Royston. How come the fans think or thought that Rob Royston was a good idea, but thought an exactly the same proposal for Campus Lang was wrong? The first person to suggest a move away from Celtic Park was Brian Dempsey. People thought that was wonderful. The fans were going to support that. Then we proposed Campus Lang much nearer, just down the road, on a site, incidentally, where the Glasgow Herald is now printed. There's nothing wrong with the site at all. All this nonsense about poisoned ground and all that, it was just propaganda. That site is now fully developed. There would have been a hotel and various other things on it just now. Fans think Campus Lang was a terrible idea. I thought Rob Royston was a good idea. And it doesn't make any sense at all. Now, the way it's worked out, and you couldn't predict this at the time, the way it's worked out, with the Commonwealth Games coming to the east end of Glasgow, the decision to stay at Celtic Park has been vindicated, because you've got all the hinterland there developed. You've got adequate car parking now in places where there was housing, very, very hemmed in stadium at the time. And you've got the wonderful entrance now that the Commonwealth Games built, and the Chris Hoy Emirates Stadium across the road, and a new road up from Dalmarnock. I mean, that has worked out very well. But that, at that time, you couldn't have predicted that. At that time, moving to a new site where you could build these facilities like hotels and shops, etc., and get revenue from them, made sense if it was the right place.
The funny thing about Rob Royston, I heard you saying there about the similarities between Rob Royston and Campus Lang, that speaking as a supporter, I don't know any supporter that backed Dempsey's proposal, because we were very much, I think, as a fan base, to stay at Celtic Park, that was always the first option.
Right.
But I think what you're maybe alluding to, the fact is that the press were making it as if Celtic were missing out on some wonderful opportunity by not moving to Rob Royston.
Yeah, that's right.
So we move on. Obviously, Dempsey fell by the wayside at that point. And shortly after that, you were part of the board who appointed Terry Cassidy.
Yes.
Now, he was said to be a fairly rude and brusque in manner as an individual.
Yeah.
And he particularly handled Billy McNeil's sacking very badly when the Sun embarrassed him with his leaked document.
No, he didn't handle it very badly at all. The press made up, well, the press made Terry out to be a bad manager. If you ask Billy McNeil how his termination was handled by Terry Cassidy, he would have nothing but praise. You remember, after Billy left, he never said a single bad thing about Celtic or about Terry Cassidy. The leaked document, that was a document that was prepared in the event of the manager being sacked for the board to consider to see if this was the way they wanted to do it. Who leaked it to this day will never know. Every
was
director
it stolen?
Had a copy. Pardon?
Was it stolen, do you think?
Oh, well, not necessarily stolen, because a director could have handed it to the press.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I don't know how it got out. But I mean, they were saying, remember the cartoon, Billy Caesar getting stabbed in the back? Who were the people that were ridiculing Billy McNeil? It was the press. They did the cartoon of McNeil getting stabbed in the back. Terry Cassidy didn't do that. Mm-hmm. Terry Cassidy didn't go to the press and announce, I'm going to sack Billy McNeil. You've got to, I mean, people believe everything they read in the paper, except when it's about them.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as it's about you, you say, oh, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true. And Billy McNeil, the fact that Billy never took another job after that, suggests to me that Billy's time as a manager really was finished. I mean, he was a wonderful manager for the twice he was at Celtic Park, but like all managers, they lose the touch. Every manager's career ends in failure, doesn't it? I mean, Alec Ferguson is about the only one that survived to the end and can retire. It was sad that he had to go, but we felt that change was necessary. And in terms of the way his termination was handled by Terry, it was done properly, and Billy McNeil his settlement was very, very generous. As a man of his calibre, as a player and a manager deserves.
Getting back to Cassidy, he did fall out with a fair number of people, but in due to his personality.
Yeah.
Do you regret maybe having him in? Was he a help or a hindrance at that time?
I still keep in touch with Terry Cassidy. I've been on holiday with him, play golf with him. Terry Cassidy was a wonderful manager. He managed the Glasgow Herald Group, and he managed the Irish Times Group in Dublin. He had an outstanding record of being a manager. But at that time, the way the press were decided to attack Celtic, nobody was ever going to be given a chance there.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he had been manager in the Glasgow Herald Group, I think, harmed him as well, because journalists who may have come up against him at that time
had an agenda.
Had a very clear agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't regret appointing Terry. I think Terry could have done a good job, but the press were never, ever going to let him go. And if you look back in the press at that time, it was absolutely ridiculous and ludicrous. And if you look back at the way the banks treated Celtic as well, well, they now, of course, the banks have actually put the whole economy down. So not surprised that they did the thing first of all to Celtic.
Now, there was always a cordial relationship between Celtic and Rangers boards of directors. And
there was, yes.
You witnessed that by John Lawrence stood in the tarmac at Glasgow Airport when we came back with the European Cup. And also the Celtic directors attended some of the funerals at the time of the Ibrox disaster.
Oh, yes.
And on behalf of the club. Now, when David Murray took over, he once famously said that he would spend a tenner for every fiver that we did. And he also made a ploy of banning Celtic fans from a game at Ibrox, which was rather ironic given the record the Rangers have in certain competitions through the years. So how did you find the relationship between the directors at that point? And did it deteriorate under Murray?
The relationship between the two clubs was always very cordial, because they had the same kind of problems, and the rest of Scottish football didn't particularly like Celtic and Rangers because of their strength. So from my grandfather's time, and he told my father that Rangers had, in the very early 30s, Rangers needed money. They were short of money, and They came to him, his house out in Blantyre, Thornhill, Blantyre, and he gave Rangers a loan privately in order to tide them over a short-term difficulty. So the relationship between the two clubs was always very good. I mean, the rivalry was bitter. I mean, you know, you wanted to win, they wanted to win, were shouting aggressively for our teams in the director's box. But at 20-5, when games normally ended, you shook hands and got on with it, and that was it. And I remained on cordial terms with all. Willie Waddle was bad tempered. I mean, bad loser, Willie Waddle. That's why he's such a great player. But really, the relationships were excellent until Murray came, and Murray soured the relationships. Murray didn't want, you see, he didn't want the old firm. He didn't want a relationship with Celtic. He wanted Rangers alone, and he was going to take them into England or into Europe, and he didn't want to depend on this rivalry with Celtic. So he deliberately set out to do Celtic down in every way he could. Now, he never said to me, I'm going to spend £10 for every £5 you spend. But he did say to me, we're going to leave you miles behind. We're going to leave you miles behind. And we went again at Ibrox once. He wanted to show off his new stand. He had a big...
The club deck.
What?
The club deck. The new tier. The
new club deck. He was going to... So he came into the director's room and he said to the Celtic director before the game, come on, would you like to see the stand? And Tom Grant, Jack, Chris all walked out of the room and I just stood where I was. And he turned around and said, you coming, Michael? I said, no, it's okay, David. I've seen a stand.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not too pleased, but I wasn't going to play his game. I mean, just wanted to rub our noses in it. This is my wonderful stand. Well, as we all know now.
How did you find him as a man, though? Was he a friendly character, or was he quite sort of aloof?
No, he wasn't aloof at all. He was friendly, voluble, he would talk, but there was always that agenda, there was always that edge. You felt, you know, he's really just... He's always out to make a point. He couldn't actually leave a conversation without making a point, trying to put you down. I was able to stand up to that, but it's a laugh now to think of all this boastfulness was based on absolutely nothing.
So history now shows us that Murray and Rangers were bankrolled by the Bank of Scotland, the same bank that ironically...
No, it was a Royal Bank.
These are all different
bank.
Yeah.
But different agenda as well.
Right.
He got his money... How he got it, God knows, from the Royal Bank. They gave him billion after billion.
So who was Celtic's bankers at that point?
The Bank of Scotland.
Right, but Masterton was involved with the Bank of Scotland, wasn't he?
Yes, Bank of Scotland, Masterton.
Right. So what I was going to say there was, given the fact that Rangers were getting basically free credit, and our bank was putting the clamps on us financially, you know, were you aware of that at the time that Murray was getting the credit?
No, we thought Murray had all the money in the world. We were a rich... successful businessman. He was telling everybody he was putting his money into Rangers, wasn't he? We didn't know he was going in the back of whatever assets he thought he had. I mean, he got too big. The banks couldn't put him down, or the banks wouldn't put him down. It was very ironic that he's in for millions and millions and tens of millions, and Celtic were 5 or 6 million, and the bank was threatening us with all sorts of things. I mean, it was appalling the way the banking establishment treated Rangers and Celtic entirely differently.
So how do you feel now then, now that it's all come out in the wash about Murray and all the rest of this stuff?
Well, I feel, first of all, that I was right to try and defend the Celtic principles and to keep Celtic going in the way it had gone, and that we should not... You see, the fans wanted Celtic to go down the road of Rangers. That was the thing. Rangers are doing that, you should do that as well. Now I would like to say to those fans, well... I don't think I had more foresight than you had, that we should not have gone down the road of David Murray. You fell for a false prospectus there. He conned us into thinking he was going to build this wonderful empire, and now his club is no more. So I feel vindicated in that really we weren't prepared to do what he was going to do and resort to those kind of methods. And I feel very sad because he has... changed the nature of Celtic by the fact that he put pressure on the Celtic fans and the Celtic fans demanded that. I see the club as different now. It's the same, it's exactly the same club has continued, obviously. It was no liquidation or anywhere near liquidation, quite frankly. But I just see in the objectives of the club, it's slightly different. And having said that, I've got to remind myself that in terms of charity, Celtic are giving more to charity now than they ever gave in the past. because they are turning over more money and they do tremendous events for charity. So they haven't lost sight of that, but they've lost sight of the football team first. So that's my reflection on Murray. And if Murray hadn't come along like that, then things would have been very different from Celtic. If I can just talk about the Rangers fans trying to make a comparison between the two and say that Celtic were going into liquidation. Celtic were never, ever going into liquidation. The bank, Fergus McCann, deposited money with the Bank of Scotland. So they knew he had money. And the only reason they threatened us with that was because they knew that before we let that happen, he would step in. And that's exactly what happened. The Bank of Scotland engineered our exit and his entry by the pressure they put on Celtic. And it was quite unfair. And I wrote to the governor of the Bank of Scotland at the time and told him, because I knew him, Bruce Patullo, I knew him personally. Mm-hmm. He dealt with me. He knew the kind of person I was when I was Lord Provost. He admired me, complimented me, and yet he allowed his under-managers to do this. So it was really disgusting what they did. And when it now comes out that the Royal Bank was bankrolling Rangers for years on the back of nothing, then it's doubly galling.
So when Billy McNeil moved on, Liam Brady was appointed manager in 1991.
Yeah.
Now, it has to be said, Brady was a disappointment. He was given substantial funds. I think one of the things at the time, looking back on the likes of Cascarino and Gillespie and Stuart Slater, there were huge fees at the time. Massive, Scottish football standards, massive fees. So they may not have been...
Did he sign Gillespie?
He did. That was one of his first signings, yeah. So it may not have been what Rangers were spending, but it was considerably more than anybody else in the Scottish game. Yes. So what were Brady's failings in your eyes?
Brady was never a manager. I mean, you couldn't have turned down Liam Brady as your manager. When you looked at his career with Arsenal and Italy, a winner, a superb player. On the face of it, he looked like a perfect manager. He knew about Celtic. He seemed to be the perfect choice. You couldn't turn him down. But as it transpired, in my opinion, he had no managerial abilities or skills. And again, that's been demonstrated because of the fact he's never made it as a manager. He's back at Arsenal as a youth coach or something. So he was a terrible disappointment because I thought this is a man who really has got, as a footballer, he was a genius, but just lacked the personality to be able to manage.
I mean, there was a four-man shot at the time. There was Tommy Craig, there was Liam, Frank Stapleton and Ivan Golak.
Yes.
Again, I know we're talking about hindsight, looking back on it, but there's one of the other guys there make you think he could have done it differently.
Oh, yes, I think so. I mean, as I say, with Brady's CV, you couldn't have turned him down.
Mm.
And the others haven't. I mean, Tommy Craig has never made it as a manager, just been fired out since Martin. He was always a number two, Tommy. He's a good number two, but he's never going to be a number one. Stapleton, again, I don't think he's made anything.
No.
Golak, of the four, he was probably the guy that had some managerial experience, and he might have done a bit better. But we wouldn't have looked past Brady, and he resigned, if you remember. We didn't track Brady. He resigned after the game at St Johnstone. I mean, dreadful results. I mean, you know, even with a bad team, we should have been getting better results than we did. You know, a manager that could motivate the team would have beaten the likes of.
Well, what was going to move on to there was that at that period, Celtic, around the period rather, Celtic had guys like McStay, Collins, Bonner, Boyd, Nicholas, Craney, Coyne, Paul Ehrlich was there for a short while. These guys were all fine players. And I think what became frustrating for everyone, fans and board of directors alike. The 1990 League Cup final against Rangers, Jack Inofsky missed a sitter when it was one each.
Right through the goalkeeper.
The 1991 Scottish Cup semi-final replay against Motherwell, it was two each at a time and the boy O'Neill scored a wonder goal for 35 yards. And then there was one the next year, I think it was against Rangers at Hampden, a horrible wet night that we should have, without being biased, we should have had at least two, if not three penalties.
Yeah.
And Rangers were down to 10 men and they hung on for victory. But do you feel now, again, looking back, that a trophy at that point, a wee bit of luck would have deflected a lot of the pressure?
Oh, yes. I think if we'd won that originally, the League Cup.
That would have been a big boost.
Aye. That would have been. And I remember Jack Inofsky right through. Mm. I remember Billy McNeil in the dressing room before the game, looking him in the eyes, they were the same height, looking at me. He says, Jackie, I need you tonight. I need you tonight. And he didn't deliver. No. The one chance he had, it was an extra time, I think.
Yeah, it wasn't long before I think Rangers got the winning goal. And it's funny, I can recall it in my mind very clearly. Rogan went a great run. He ran about 30, 40 yards.
Yeah.
He got through a couple of tackles and he slipped a lovely ball through him. And it was almost a pass back because Chris would just almost fail on the ball.
Aye.
You know, he didn't even need to work for it. It was a pitiful effort.
And then, of course, we lost in the cup final with penalties to Aberdeen.
That was,
I mean, that was
bad luck also.
What was it, 9-8 on penalties?
Rogan missed the
decision. Rogan. Rogan beat Yulsey and anybody but him to miss it. He felt so sorry for Rogan.
Who was that, Billy?
Billy? Billy, yeah. The bus came back, he said, because he said, the rest can shrug it off. It'll stay with him because he was such a fan.
Now, Lou McCarry replaced Brady.
Yeah.
Do you think McCarry was committed to Celtic?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. 100% to committed to Celtic. Yes, yeah. Lou was a much better manager. Lou knew what he was trying to do. But the funds had run out by that time, so we couldn't, give Brady the $2 million and the extra $2 million. We couldn't give that to McCarry. So he had to manage with very, very much poorer players than Brady had. But yes, I mean, he had family connections down in England and they didn't want to break them. But I've seen Lou since then, and I know Lou and I admire him very much. And he would have, in different circumstances, he would have been a good manager.
Mm-hmm. So at that stage, the board were receiving great criticism in the press. Yep. You were very much experienced in the PR world.
Yeah.
Do you think it became personal with the press at one point?
Oh, very much. Very, very, very.
Well,
very.
Why would that have been?
Because the other side targeted me. I mean, Fergus had PR people working for him. This was, people think that this was just Fergus sitting back there watching us stumbling from crisis to crisis. The rebels, as they called themselves, had an organised campaign against Celtic. It was boycotting games, they were boycotting the shops. Now, what effect does that have on your revenues? They wanted to bring the club down so they could pick it up for nothing. That was the plan, was make Celtic as uneconomic as possible. The shares will be worth nothing. We can walk in and pick it up. And they all made money out of it. All the people that bought the shares at the beginning, Fergus made 35 million. Now, who did he make it from?
Shareholders.
Well?
The market.
Well, he told the shares, because the fans bought the shares, they pushed the price up. Mm-hmm. So, it was done. It was done as an operation to take over a failing company and turn it round.
Again, we're going back to weak leadership, perceived weak leadership at that time. And I don't think Jack McGinn or Kevin Kelly were particularly great Celtic chairman.
No, there was a weakness, you see. But I'm trying to... I'm on there on the inside, I'm one of five or seven on the board, and I'm trying to affect that change. But, I never had complete control at all.
Never think about going for the chairmanship?
No, I wouldn't do that in front of Kevin. No, I wouldn't have put Kevin off as chairman. I mean, people expected me to take the chairmanship when Kevin took it over, but I wouldn't. In terms of the family, you'd refer to the fight with my father and Bob Kelly. I was determined that wasn't going to happen. So was Kevin. He wasn't going to fall out with me. But it was just that there was no one sufficiently strong control at that time. And so there was no policy, no way forward. And we're getting attacked from the outside by people that wanted to bring the club down, didn't want to pay money for the shares. I mean, if these guys really had Celtic's interest at heart, they would have come along to the shareholders and said to the directors, look, we are making an offer of £500 a share, or £300 a share, or £100 a share, put that to the shareholders, and if the shareholders accept it, we'll take over the club. Now, directors would have been obliged to do that. We'd have had to put an offer like that to the shareholders. Mm-hmm. An offer never came because they didn't want to pay for the club. They wanted to pick it up for nothing. So there was a campaign of attrition to wear the club down, wear the board down. Eventually, the bank got fed up and said, you've got to get out and let these guys take over. So Fergus paid me £300 a share for my shares. This is the point I want to make about Fergus took over a bankrupt club. If the club was bankrupt, why would anybody pay £300 a share? The only reason somebody would pay £300 a share is because he thought it was worth more than £300 a share. Mm-hmm. And that proved correct. When Fergus took it over, he put the money in, he got the fans to buy shares, and he walks away with £35 million. So there was no question of us bringing the club to the point of bankruptcy. The shares were extremely valuable when Fergus took the club over. It was a completely viable proposition. And if there hadn't been this attack on the club from the outside of people wanting to take it over for their own ends and make money for themselves, then it would never have been in that crisis.
That moves us on to the proposed move ground to Cambuslang in 1992-93.
Yeah.
Now, through David Smith, who came on the board at that time, and a guy called Patrick Nally?
He wasn't on the board, he was
no,
just
but
an
he was involved as in negotiations.
Yeah. Yeah.
A £20 million guarantee of funding was given by the Swiss bankers Geffen.
Yeah.
Now, this is a difficult part because the nail in the coffin for the board was the fact that Geffen denied it publicly.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
what was going on there at the time? Why would the Swiss bankers deny making a... Banks are there to make money and lend money, so why would they deny that they were involved with Celtic?
Well, it's a very complicated answer, and I really would have to refer you to my book because I spell it out there over 3 or 4 pages. But basically, what a bank can't do is if all the legal papers haven't been signed up and they have got the guarantees and securities that they want, then the deal isn't there. So they're not going to say we have offered money when the deal isn't complete, because then they would be tied to offering that money. If they had said to the press, yes, we are going to invest £20 million in Celtic, we'd have held them to that, and they would have been in a very weak position as far as the terms and conditions are concerned. But I don't know if you've got a copy of my book. If you do have, please read that, refer to that, and maybe you could edit it into this interview. But I mean, I don't remember the details at the time, but I remember that was the general principle, that the money was, we were doing a deal with Geffenor, and we would have done a deal with them, but they were not prepared to admit to the press. They were not going to confirm to the press what the deal was. I mean, Swiss banks, as you know, are secretive and private, and it wasn't for them to discuss it at the Evening Times. So it was really untrue to say that the money wouldn't have been there for the deal. Would have been there.
Would you say that was the first time that you within yourself, that you might have thought that we've lost and we might have to give it up now because...
Yeah.
That was the last...
No, because we would have... I mean, that was just a press headline. We would have carried on meeting Geffenor and discussing with Geffenor. That wasn't going to affect our relationship with them at all. That was just for the readers of the Evening Times.
Mm-hmm. Was there a point that you thought that's it?
No.
That it's gone? Up till then, you were still optimistic?
Not until the bank called us in and threatened us in a way that they didn't threaten Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
That they wanted their money back. Because they knew that McCann was sitting there with his money in another account that he would transfer in. The irony is, of course, that we had been, the Bank of Scotland had been our banker for 106 years. Well, it shows you how little McCann trusted them. As soon as you get any twitch banks, because if they treated us like that, then there was no reason why they wouldn't treat him like that afterwards.
Well, I think Fergus went for him for credit and they weren't very forthcoming, and that's why he did move.
Yeah, and he went to the cooperative bank. I don't know what the story is, but the point is he fired them. He got another bank in, and they didn't deserve. Well, that's a friend coming in.
Now, at that time, it wasn't just Fergus who was going to go looking to buy. There was two camps. There was Fergus, there was the McCann Dempsey camp, and there was a Wisefield hockey camp.
No, I don't think it was a McCann Dempsey camp. Dempsey was never a McCann's camp.
McCann was on his own.
Well, he was encouraging all these guys. And he was, you know, I don't know what the relationship was between them, but no, Dempsey wasn't in his camp, and Dempsey never delivered any money to Celtic, as you know.
Mm.
He never became a director, he never put money in. But there was Hawkey and Wisefield, yes.
Did you have a preference at that time for one or the other?
No, not at all. I didn't want to sell to anybody.
So, but were you disappointed at that point? But when I think Kevin went in with the Rebels at one point, towards the end?
Yes, he did, in the last day.
And did that disappoint you?
Yeah, well, it did.
So, I know it's a painful time for you to look back on, but can you accept criticism that you were only interested in selling your shares to the highest bidder at a time when Celtic were close to financially?
No, that's rubbish. I didn't want to sell my shares to anybody. The whole point of us being on the board was to try and turn Celtic round. But we've been savaged by the press, we've been attacked by this coalition of rebels who wanted to pick the club up on the cheap. And I certainly wasn't going to hand my shares over for nothing to anybody. So I don't accept any criticism of that. There was no other bid for my shares. I never met Willie Hawkey or Weisfeld. I never had any discussion with them about buying or selling shares. I only had that discussion, in fact, with Kevin on the very last day when he had changed sides and he indicated that McCann had a certain amount of money to buy shares that would give him a foothold in the club. And at that point, I agreed to sell my shares because I wasn't prepared to work with Fergus after what he'd put the club through.
Mm. So in your book in 1994, you end the book by having reservations about Fergus's ability to build a new Celtic Park.
I did, yes. So I was completely wrong.
Well, you're man enough to admit it. What I was going to say is, what's your opinion of the new Celtic Park?
Celtic Park's fantastic, wonderful. I've been in both the main stand and I've been in the Janefield Road end, and I think the facilities are first class. Hospitality is great. The food is excellent. The vision of the ground is terrific. I think it's a marvellous stadium.
And how would you have rated McCann's tenure over his 5-year period?
He built the stadium. He didn't build the team. We were humiliated the first time in Celtic history. We lost a cup final to a team in the lower division, Raith Rovers. And we've gone on to create records like that ever since, getting beaten by Ross County, Inverness, Cali, Thistle twice. I mean, you know, this, for all our stumbling and bumbling as a bungling board, we never had results like that. Never in the history were Celtic put out the cup by teams from a lower division. So in terms of the finances and the business, Fergus did what he promised. In terms of the team, he had the worst results in Celtic history.
And what's your opinion?
And what did they win? Did they win the league?
98, yeah.
Until 98,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. 5 years.
The one thing I would give Fergus credit for, I think you have to acknowledge, that he was fighting a battle on two fronts at that point. He was having to build a stadium and a team at the same time, and as Rangers had such an advantage.
He walked away with 35 million. Why did he not put that into the team?
We didn't have that at the time, though. That came afterwards.
Well, no, it was building up. Mm. It was building up over the period. So there was plenty of money there.
But he always
didn't go into the team.
He always did say after 5 years he would depart.
Why? Because by that time he'd made his money.
Okay. Well, what's your opinion on the current Celtic board at the moment?
I think the Celtic board are very efficient, highly competent, excellent managers. I think they run the club prudently. And I think they have to be complimented on what they've done in not only stabilising Celtic, but in building up reserves against any future problems. They're struggling against great difficulties. They've got the difficulty of being in a very small country, having no competition whatsoever in the league. I mean, they could win the league this year looking back, and no prospects of big television revenues, etc. So they're struggling against a very poor climate for football in Scotland. But I would like to see them spending more money on the team to try and at least get through, have a team that was good enough competently to get through the group stages of the European Championship.
Mm. And these days, do you still go along to the Celtic games?
I was there. I was there yesterday, if you're dating this. I was there at the first of the new series of games between Celtic and another Glasgow team, playing blue. And I must say, it was an extremely disappointing game because Celtic were maybe two or three leagues better than the other team. And it's nice to qualify for another cup final, but I just wish we had more opposition that day, made it a more interesting game.
Yeah, I think what was noticeable yesterday was the fact that Celtic were, not only were, I think, oh, it goes without saying, a better team, player against player, head for head, but I think we also looked fitter as well. I thought Rangers were pretty poor in terms of fitness.
I thought Celtic were just superior in all departments, individuals and in terms of spirit and aggression and ability and teamwork and tactics. Mm-hmm. It's just been a huge gulf between the two teams.
I was teasing a friend of mine at work, and I said that that's me. I can recall going to the first ever Celtic Meadowbank Thistle game. I can recall going to the first Celtic Gretna game, and now I've seen the first Celtic Rangers game in the new era.
Well, thanks very much for coming to interview me.
Yeah, that's been material. Most enjoyable, and just to wish you all the best for the future.
Right, thank you.
Hope you enjoyed listening to that. As I said at the beginning, there's always multiple sides to every story, and history is written by the victors. In the instance of the battle for the future of Celtic Football Club, Michael Kelly was one of the losers, so it's always interesting to get his side of events. For those of us over the age of 30, we will have our own recollections of matters, and it'll be interesting to see anybody's opinion was changed one way or the other from that. But like the podcast, the Jock Brown podcast we had previously, and the Brian Dempsey podcast also. One of the things that happened after Michael Kay left and Fergus McCann took over the running of Celtic Football Club was the introduction of the Celtic charity as a mainstay part of the club. And since then, obviously in recent times, it's the Celtic FC Foundation with Tony Hamilton at the helm. It's doing fantastic work. If you follow it, if you on the website, if you follow Celtic's tweets, Tony Hamilton's tweets, Celtic Research has done a recent number of tweets highlighting the work that it's done. I'd advise you to please go on the website and see what's happening. Coming up events are the Zip Wire at Celtic Park. I think there may be a handful of places left where you can raise money for charity and go from one side of the park to the other from a great height, if that's your thrill. I'll be doing it. There is a golf day for those people who are into that side of thing, which has just been announced by the club. There's tons of things to get online. There's the Carden Den Cycle, there's the Hurdle on Ben Nevis, there's the Glasgow Marathon, various other events to go to. Go to Celtic FC Foundation to find out, go on the Celtic website for clicks to links and that. These are the things that make our club special and make the supporters different and make us more than any other club. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that fantastic interview with St Anthony and Michael Kelly. This is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight. Goodnight.